Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a writer and a broadcaster, but for the purposes of this podcast, I'm your chief investigator of images. Today we have tackled one of the biggest paintings, I think, in Western art, one of the most famous, Michelangelo's Creation of Adam. And I'm joined by my dear friend and colleague in Oxford, Patrick Dorley, author of an amazing book, The Truth About Art, a book that's really made me reconsider what we do as art historians and take us back to this idea of quality and the essence of the skill of the artist. Patrick, thank you for talking to me today.
Not at all.
We work very closely together. We teach the diploma in history of art together, don't we?
Yes.
As well.
And the certificate.
And the certificate at the Department of Continuing Education. And when I asked you what image you wanted to do, I wasn't sure. You're a Renaissance man, really. I can use that term, but you're happy in the Renaissance. You went for about the biggest hit of the lot, didn't
Why
you?
Why not?
So you thought you'd go big.
Yes.
Why this one, then?
Well, it is one of the sort of canonical images of Western art. And Michelangelo is perhaps the best known sculptor, painter and architect in Western art. So why not go for the biggest hitter of them all?
And I suppose one of the things we take for granted with this image, it's known as the Creation of Adam, but the bit that we often see reproduced on tea towels and Christmas cards is the hand, isn't it? The touching
yes.
of God's hand with Adam's hand, that close up. But it is, of course, part of a much bigger scheme. So
yes.
date-wise, we're looking at 1508?
Yes. We know he made a note when he was given the first payment of 300 ducats in his day book on the 10th of May, 1508, and he said, I'm to start this very day. And he worked for 3 years, actually. And then there was a hiatus of 1 year when the Pope left Rome. He was in Ferrara and Bologna for a year. Then the Pope returned, the half ceiling was unveiled, and Michelangelo completed the second half in just 1 year.
Good grief. And this is a huge building. I mean, if you visited the Sistine Chapel, it is a massive space, isn't it?
It's 41 metres long, and the height from the floor is about 40 feet or 13 metres. In fact, the proportions of the Sistine Chapel are based on the measurements given for the Temple of Solomon in the Book of Kings. And that was supposedly 60 by 20 by 30 cubits. And the Pope who built it, Sixtus IV, after whom it's named, clearly chose that as a model. So the ceiling is, as I say, 13 metres or 40 feet high without any supports.
Yes.
It doesn't have aisles. It didn't originally have external buttresses. And this caused the problem. And this is why the ceiling was painted.
So the problem was?
The cracks appeared,
right.
25 years later. It was built around about 1480. And in 1504, in the spring of 1504, cracks appeared.
So that's just 25 years after it's built.
Yes.
It's already this issue of not... Because I think that's what's so magnificent about the space. There are no columns. There's nothing obstructing your view, as you
It's
expect.
A single hall space.
But, of course, that has its issues. So cracks appeared... And then we get out of Sixtus and into Julius II, the warrior pope.
Julius was the nephew of Sixtus the Fourth. Popes don't have sons, as you know.
They shouldn't.
They have nephews, so if they want to pass on their connections and their prestige to their family, they have to appoint nephews as cardinals. So Giuliano della Rovere was made a cardinal by Sixtus, and in 1503, the year before the cracks appeared, he was elected pope.
Right.
So in a sense, this is a family chapel. Originally, the Della Rovere arms were displayed on the ceiling. So a cracked ceiling with your family arms on it was actually bad news for Pope Julius II.
Yes, what a horrible thought, an omen, exactly. Yes. But also, I think this is something that we sort of have to think about with this period coming into the 16th century. The papacy is so powerful, or at least it's, I mean, certainly under Julius, he's trying to increase the power, the reach of the papacy, making it into a military state as much as anything else, isn't he? Yes. And art is part of that program.
Yes, he needed to display to the world the prestige and the power of the papacy. He probably wanted to recover the prestige of ancient Rome. And this is a brief period of papal power because, as you know, in the 14th century, the papacy had been taken to the south of France by the French king. Then it had lived a peripatetic existence for half a century and only really established itself back in Rome around about in the 1450s. Sixtus IV was the pope who started to spend money in a big way. And Julius now had all the resources of Christendom at his command. And shortly afterwards, the Reformation began. So the Pope's resources were cut shortly after this. This is peak period for papal power and papal resources.
Amazing. And into this environment steps this brilliant man, Michelangelo. I mean, he is, I find him absolutely astonishing because of his skills across different mediums, but also underneath it all, this poetry, this writing, he documents, which is so helpful for us as art historians, isn't it?
Well, in particular, he wrote a ghosted autobiography. Giorgio Vasari wrote the famous Lives of the Most Excellent Architects, Sculptors and Painters in 1550. And he was looking at the lives of Italian artificers for the last 300 years. And he brings his narrative to a climax with the life of Michelangelo. Mm. Michelangelo is the only living master at the time in 1550. All the others were dead. So Michelangelo is given star billing and his fame has never been eclipsed.
It's a funny one as art historians, isn't it? Because in a way, the birth of our discipline is Vasari.
Yes.
All roads lead to Vasari.
Yes.
And there is an awful lot of contrivance and bias in Life of the Artist, isn't there?
Well, I mean, every piece of writing has a certain self-interest from the writer. But interestingly, Michelangelo obviously wasn't happy with the life that Vasari had written, because 3 years later, this alternative life emerged, was published, and it was written by Ascanio Condivi, who was a sort of pupil of Michelangelo. And none of us today doubt that this is not Michelangelo's voice. So we do have some remarks by Michelangelo himself on this ceiling.
Right. Oh, gosh. Okay. So what does he say?
Well,
he didn't want to do it, did he? I mean, that was the first thing we should say, that he was primarily a sculptor up to this point.
Yes. He had established his reputation in Rome with that wonderful Pietà, the lovely image of the Madonna with the dead Christ, the grown-up dead Christ on her lap. That was just before 1500. Then just after 1500, he produced the wonderful David in Florence. So by 1505, he was well known. He was famous. And Julius decided that he should make his tomb.
Yeah.
So he brings Michelangelo to Rome in 1505.
Poaches him from Florence.
That's right. Michelangelo, all excited, comes up with this fantastic design of a tomb with 40 sculpted figures on it. The Pope appears twice, goes to the quarries in Carrara, brings back all this marble, and then the Pope changes his priorities.
Yeah.
He decides he wants to knock down Old St. Peter's and build New St. Peter's. This is 1506. So his money and his interest shift to that. And Michelangelo goes off in a great temper and they fall out for a few years.
This is so interesting because, of course, one of the other key players in this is Bramante as well, he's not happy about Michelangelo getting all these commissions. So is it true that he suggests this project?
Bramante?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. the Pope had to occupy Michelangelo. He had the problem with the cracks on his uncle's ceiling. And he decided he wasn't just going to patch it, he was going to repaint it.
Because it was blue originally, wasn't it?
It was the night sky, blue with stars on it. And Michelangelo, in his ghosted autobiography, said he didn't want to do it because he wanted to plug away with the tomb, the sculpted tomb. But probably he's protesting too much because after the Pope's death, and he died just a few months after the ceiling was completed in 1513, Michelangelo signed a contract with the Pope's heirs for a cut-down tomb and took the money but never delivered the tomb. So one of the reasons we think he wrote this ghosted autobiography was to exculpate himself for not having delivered the tomb. And so he says, I wanted to do work on the tomb, but the Pope took me off it and forced me to paint the ceiling.
So he's covering his back.
He's doing that, yes.
Oh, because I mean, we have this image, don't we, of him reluctantly clambering up this scaffold every day and painstakingly lying on his back and
painting
against his will.
Well, I don't know where that image comes from. Maybe it comes from Charlton Heston, The Agony and the Ecstasy, this film of the 1950s. And my generation of people may have seen that film and their attitudes coloured by it. But obviously, it's a Hollywood fiction.
Yeah. So we shouldn't think of it along those terms. This was a big project, a big commission, an important
A colossal commission.
And I think another reason, not only is it beautiful, not only is it wonderfully painted, but this, in many people's eyes, would be seen as a sort of the high point of what the Renaissance was trying to achieve, would you say?
Absolutely. If you look at the figure of Adam, it's an unforgettable image of the sheer male beauty of this nude figure. Michelangelo doesn't come up with this from his imagination. Michelangelo is a great student of classical sculpture. He doesn't want us to focus on that, but it's certainly the case. And he would have looked at ancient river gods, of reclining river gods, and they had an older tradition. They go back to the pediments of Greek temples, in which you have sculpture in the triangular shape, and you needed something to fit in the corners.
Right.
So a reclining figure fitted those corners very well.
Except, of course, because the triangular shape with the legs stretching out.
That's right.
I've never thought of that, Petri. That's wonderful. Yes.
Well, the Greeks worked on that for several centuries. Then the Romans picked up on it, particularly with their river gods. And in the Renaissance, other sculptors had borrowed from it. So there is a long history to this particular pose. And the great Sir Ernst Gombrich said that painters don't imitate nature, they imitate their predecessors.
Absolutely.
And this is what Michelangelo has done. It's a classical figure, and insofar as it's a revived classical figure, that makes it Renaissance.
Well, this is an interesting point that I had. A colleague of mine when I worked at the University of York used to say that he worked in the history department. He said, all art historians ever do is put two slides up and say, compare and contrast. And in a funny way, that is the bedrock of the discipline as well, isn't it? This idea that actually art doesn't appear in a vacuum. There is a legacy, there is a tradition of both copying and rejecting what's gone before.
Well, if you want to understand what the artist has done, you need to look at what the artist has looked at. And those are his starting points. Those are his references. Yeah. For example, the figure of God the Father on the right, surrounded by angels, that ultimately comes from the gates of paradise on the Florentine baptistry by Ghiberti a century before. Now, the whole of the story of creation is on the gates of paradise. And Michelangelo, as a Florentine, would have certainly studied it very closely.
I love those. But I mean, they're so beautiful. They're in many ways seen as sort of the birth of this new this development that leads to Michelangelo and his work, doesn't it? Because there is such classical beauty in those.
You have a reclining figure of Adam, yeah. and you have God the Father pointing to him and sort of raising him out of the earth.
Yeah.
This is the moment of creation.
And you don't subscribe to this idea that what you see with God the Father and that sort of scarf of red around him is the brain or the uterus? I've read that you could say this is a uterus and this is the umbilical cord and it's all about birth.
That is complete tosh.
Really?
If you want a reference, it comes from Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise, where you see a similar shape.
Uh-huh.
What we have here basically is two figures, Adam and God the Father. If you look at the first half of the ceiling, Michelangelo, in the Noah's Flood, for example, has about 60 figures. Mm. Then when the scaffolding came down and he saw it for the first time from 30 feet below, do I mean 30 feet?
Yes.
13 meters, 40 feet.
Yeah.
He must have been shocked at how small they looked like from the ground. So for the second half of the ceiling, his figures are much bigger.
Gosh.
And this is the first of the second half, basically two figures instead of 60.
Fantastic. So
and yet, to bulk out God the Father a little bit, he surrounds him with these child angels.
Uh-huh.
And there's that lovely image of a slightly older young woman there with her head emerging from God the Father's arm. Kenneth Clark, in his Civilization series, suggested this may have been Eve in the offing, so to speak. But the whole of that group ultimately, as I say, comes from Ghiberti.
Yeah, I mean, the woman's been variously interpreted, hasn't she? You could see a sort of the church or various different feminine personas. But yes, I think Eve's quite convincing.
Well, we need evidence for interpretation, and it could be visual evidence. He has looked at, there are other previous creations that he's looked at, and we have his own comments on the in his autobiography.
Okay, so we can say that it's definitely not a brain.
There is absolutely no evidence for a brain.
No evidence for a brain. But I love this idea then that he finally got down on the ground and looked up and thought, oh my goodness, I can't actually see half the things I've painted. I need to go bigger. I need to go bolder and clearer.
Yeah.
So he makes this a very, very clear image, particularly where he's done the hands, because the white backdrop against those hands, it accentuates them, doesn't it?
Yes.
It makes it very, very clear.
There's no distraction.
There's no distraction. And this is an important... I think the reason that certain paintings become iconic is because they seem to touch into something so simple, such a simple essence.
Mm.
And this idea that through this one touch, God is giving life to humanity in such a small and intimate gesture. Do you think that's why it's remained iconic?
Well, I think those are the modern associations of this particular gesture. Again, if I refer to Kenneth Clark, he said it's as if the spark of life is going from the finger of God the Father, jumping the gap and bringing the earth to life with the figure of Adam. But I'm afraid this is anachronistic because that spark is electrical and electricity hadn't been discovered.
Isn't it the start of which show was it? Was it the South Bank show with the two fingers?
Yes.
That's So, complete anachronism.
Complete anachronism. So, to explain it, you want to read what Michelangelo put in his Ghost autobiography.
Okay.
And I actually have got the passage here in translation, if I can find it. We read, "With his arm and with his hand extended, God is seen giving Adam the precepts for what he should do and not do. Thou shalt not eat the fruit from the forbidden tree." Now this, we think, is Michelangelo's own words. And in a sense, it's a more prosaic explanation than the moment of creation.
I feel like you've damaged some deep, lasting image in my head now, Patrick. So it's he's telling him off.
We are historians, and we go for evidence. And this is as close to what you're going to get from Michelangelo himself as you can. And I have to say that the eloquence of the visual image, that wonderful languid arm and the sort of pointing figure of God the Father, transcends this explanation.
Mm.
So it's perfectly open to us moderns to interpret it in a way which has meaning for us.
Transfers,
but historically, it is was the God the Father giving Adam his precepts.
Gosh! Again, I'm seeing this completely with new eyes now. And then, and when you think about it in that way, the way that Adam is languishing, he's receiving this instruction, but God looks very determined. The pose, the facial expression. Yes. There is a sense in which, yeah, he could be seen to be giving him instruction.
Absolutely.
How magnificent.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
If we think about this in the scheme of the Sistine Chapel then, because is it right there are as many, is it 300 figures some up there on the...
Oh, there must be more than that. I mean, there were 60 just in Noah's flood or something like that.
I think it might be 600 actually. So so there's all these different figures and they're all, what I find very fascinating as a medievalist is how in many ways this is still the doctrine of the church that we've seen repeated in church decoration going right back to, you know, 4th, 5th century basilicas. But he's treating it with this classicism, with this style that is new and unique, isn't it? Is it the style that's unique, or is the whole project in
the whole ceiling has no precedent in Italian earlier Renaissance and medieval tradition. And so you might wonder, where does it come from? And there's an answer, because nothing comes from nothing. Everything comes from something. Remember the tomb that Michelangelo was working on for the Pope?
Yes.
He was supposed to have 40 marble figures for that tomb. And no doubt he'd been making studies, and he had drawings, and he had references. And then that commission was stopped, and he was given this ceiling to paint. He had all those visual images in his imagination and in his drawings. So what is Michelangelo doing? He's actually drawing his own sculptural ideas for the tomb and painting them on the ceiling.
Good grief. Because, of course, the ones that we know that survive from the tomb, you've got the Moses that's very famous, but then also it's the captives, isn't it? The two very beautiful sinewy stuff. I think they're in the Louvre now, aren't they?
The finished ones are in the Louvre, but in the Academia, and in Florence, you've got the unfinished ones. Yeah. When the sort of abandoned ones, they seem to be struggling to release themselves from the marble. But then if you look at the Sistine ceiling, you will see that there are four large scenes of Genesis and five smaller ones. Surrounding the five smaller ones, there are these nude youths, Ennudi. And the bound captives from the tomb and these nude youths are sort of kindred spirits. They're sort of brothers. And basically, they are Michelangelo displaying his virtù, this Renaissance word, which goes back to the ancient Roman virtus. Sometimes it's translated as excellence. The stem ver is obviously goes back to the Latin word for a man. In Republican Rome, it would refer to manly excellence, sort of success in battle. But in the Renaissance, it meant excellence across the board. And Michelangelo wants to show his, I think quality is the better word to translate virtù. And he's displaying his virtù by showing he can do better what the ancients did in sculpture. Mm. And also something we forget, that the walls of the Sistine Chapel were painted in the 1480s by early Renaissance painters.
Yes, you've got a Botticelli there. You've got, yes, of course.
Indeed. And Vasari tells us that Michelangelo was determined to knock spots off those earlier paintings on the walls below. And he's been wholly successful because visitors go into the chapel, they never look.
Never, never.
They never look at the walls. They always look at the ceiling.
So he's done it. I mean, that's, again, I suppose when we talk about Vasari and the evolution of the Renaissance artists, there's a sense of that it's growing. You know, you go from Giotto and his O with this raw talent up to this pinnacle of perfection that is Michelangelo. Yes. And in a way, he's creating that himself in this space. How fantastic. Yeah. And I think what's also amazing, we do tend to zoom in and just look at details from this, but overall you've got Old Testament material on the ceiling, haven't you? And then it all reaches towards the Last Judgment up at the top.
Well, that's much later, that's 20 years later.
Right. But that was, he was trying in a way, do you think, to give the basic tenets of the Christian faith? Is this about doctrine? What is this about?
Well, it's a story of Genesis. The last fresco he painted is the first one in the story of creation. It's a separation of light from darkness. And you go from that to the drunkenness of Noah at the other end. So, you know, it's a standard Christian narrative. The huge figures, seated prophets and sibyls, are those who prophesied the coming of Christ, the Isaiah and the Cumaean sibyl and so forth. And immediately above the windows on the walls, you have the ancestors of Christ, which you get from the opening chapter of Matthew's Gospel. So-and-so begat so-and-so begat so-and-so. Yeah. Michelangelo painted all the begats, huge numbers of them, above the windows. And since the ceiling has been cleaned in the 1980s, you can really see them.
And something else I think that you can see after the conservation work, of course, was how detailed his brushwork was. Is that right? Because, you know, you mentioned to me earlier about, well, obviously, he prepared a lot with sketches, but when it came to conserving, he really painted in detail, despite the fact it was 40 foot up in the air.
Yes, Michelangelo had a traditional training. So for his panels, he painted in tempera. He wasn't an oil painter. Mm. He was very conscious later in life. He always said he was a sculptor and he became an architect because oil painting had taken over. And Michelangelo didn't paint in oil. He painted in tempera and he painted in fresco.
Just for the listeners, for the art detective listeners, painting in fresco, that's applying the paint into wet plaster, isn't
that's
it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the fascinating thing, you know, when the conservators of the 1980s were up at the ceiling, they could see the patches of wet plaster that had dried out. And Michelangelo would put out one patch per day. So the Italian word giornata is a day's work. Uh-huh. So you can see, looking at these patches, that Michelangelo took 16 days, I beg your pardon, 14 days to complete the creation of Adam.
14 days for that full image.
And not only that, but we can look at the sequence in which he worked.
Heavens.
Because the plaster overlaps a little bit. So we can see that he started in the top right-hand corner with a group of angels and the billowing drapery. Day two, he painted the head of God the Father.
Good grief.
Day three, that female figure who may or may not be Eve. And so on. And he finished with the figure of Adam. So the head of Adam, which is what he started in day 11, he just spent the whole day getting the head right. then the magnificent torso, the knee in day 13, and day 14, the last day, that stretched out leg and the ground behind it.
Oh, my goodness. So I need to get my head around this. So the conservators got up close and they, from looking at where one patch had dried and overlapped with the other, could create a day-by-day
That's
process.
Right. Yes.
That is amazing.
Yes,
a diary
is.
in plaster.
Yes.
Fantastic. And I mean, just the boldness of it, to be able to start off and conceive of this scheme. But he did sketch, didn't he? So he would have planned the whole image beforehand, is that right?
Well, he certainly would have done that. And one particularly magnificent drawing survives. It's a red chalk drawing that's in the British Museum today. And fortunately for us, it is actually the figure of Adam. It is the magnificent torso and the raised leg and the outstretched arm. He hasn't included the head or the pointing fingers. But in a sense, this is a more splendid study than the finished painting.
Absolutely. There's much more definition in it, isn't there, actually?
The topography of muscle and bone is described on a scale and with a grandeur that is inimitably Michelangelo. So whatever his influences were from classical sculpture and Ghiberti and other people, the finished result cannot be confused with anyone else. This is Michelangelo, pure and simple.
Because this is what, this fascinates me about him. Is it, it's the case that when the Laocoon came up, when the ancient sculpture of the Laocoon was discovered in the Vatican, Michelangelo saw it.
He was one of the first to see it in 1506 when it was dug out of a vineyard.
And it is an extraordinary piece, isn't it? You've got the central male figure, the two sons either side, all sinewy and wrapped up battling with these serpents.
That's right. Yes.
And it's what, by that stage, it was over 1,000 years in the ground,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
But that would have influenced him. And yet he does something else, doesn't he? He goes beyond that.
Well, in the figure of Adam, he's not actually influenced by that, because the Laocoon is a twisting figure with his head turned in the opposite direction to his torso. And the last figure that Michelangelo painted is a Jonah. If you look immediately above the altar, you see this colossal Jonah. You can identify him because he's got a whale. It actually looks like a fish to us moderns, but Michelangelo hadn't seen a whale. So you can see that figure of Jonah, and that is very close to the Laocoon.
So he's pulling all these different bits of evidence from the past, but he the way he understands the body, he builds it up from the inside out. Is that how we think he worked?
Well, we think he did make anatomical dissections and drawings. I don't know that we've got any evidence for Michelangelo. I think there could be some drawings of skeletons. Leonardo, of course, is the great student of anatomy. We have lots of his anatomical drawings. But Michelangelo probably made some dissections. But he's not interested in the workings of the body as Leonardo became. He's only interested in anatomy to serve his interest in sculpture and painting.
And again, one of the things that comes down to us about Michelangelo is that when he sculpted in stone, he could see the figure inside. And there's this wonderful sort of creation myth going on where he's releasing the figure from the stone. But that, you know, we do sort of see that in the aborted pieces that went into the papal sculpture, don't we?
Yeah, that's a sort of modern, eloquent way of describing it. But we do know Michelangelo's process for that, because he started with a wax or a clay or a wax figure. You don't cut straight into marble because you can't correct what you've done. So he worked out his figures in wax, and Vasari tells us what he then did. He laid the figure in a tank of water, and the tank really should be the same proportions as the block of marble. Then he would let out the water, and where an elbow stuck out or a knee stuck out, he would then cut down the marble to that point. And you can do that with a twisty figure. The lower the level of the water is his guide for releasing the figure.
Oh, Patrick, you're telling me things I don't know. This is absolutely fantastic. I did not know that. That's incredible. So when it comes to paint on a flat surface, I suppose there is a hankering after depth and dimension,
certainly,
isn't there?
Yes.
Which you can see he's trying to to do that here. This is a very deep image. It draws you in. And actually, I think that's something that's so confusing about the whole of the Sistine Chapel ceiling is this idea of where one figure ends, another begins perspective. He had to do all of that while up close with a brush.
Yes. It's interesting that you're looking up at it, but all the figures are seen from the side. Mm-hmm. They're not seen from below. It is a later generation that show foreshortened figures from below. Mm. It's Correggio in Parma who has this vaulted the dome over the cathedral in Parma, and you look up people's legs.
Yeah.
For Michelangelo's ceiling, they're all from the side except for one, which is a later one than the creation of Adam. I'm trying to find it on my computer as I'm talking.
Yeah.
I think it's the...
Is it the Sibyl?
It's the separation of light from darkness. You can see God the Father's head from below, uh-huh, looking up his nostrils. It's actually not a good way to look at anyone.
So, it's not the most flattering, is it?
Exactly. So Michelangelo doesn't do it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, when he would lose so much of the definition of the form so special about it. In terms of this being such a famous image. You talk in your book, The Truth About Art, about quality, about recognising true quality.
Mm.
Is it the quality of this that has made it such an iconic figure for this image for so long?
Sir Ernst Gombrich came up with a wonderful... It was actually a lecture he gave here in Oxford in the Sheldonian Theatre, and he looked up at the painting above the Sheldonian Theatre, which shows truth descending and all the arts in the university imploring truth to come down and reveal itself to the university. And Gombrich pointed out that tourists in their thousands don't come to the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford to look at this ceiling. It's by Robert Streeter, who was sergeant painter to Charles II. They do go to the Sistine Chapel in Rome. Mm-hmm. And the difference isn't about subject matter. It's about the fact that Michelangelo is a marvellous painter and Robert Streeter is not in that league. Mm. There is a qualitative difference between the two.
Having spent long graduation ceremonies staring at that, I have to agree. So there is something about the quality, but also the composition. It's particularly this section. It's so restrained and yet so powerful. The use of colour, the use of white space as well. It is extraordinary. Mm. I really hope that you Art Detective listeners have enjoyed all of this. There is still so much we could talk about, isn't there, Patrick?
Yeah.
But we've already been talking for a long time. Thank you for talking to me about this image and telling me things I honestly did not know. I'm walking out reeling from this conversation.
Well, it's been no hardship talking about Michelangelo, I can promise you.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. If you've enjoyed this, you can subscribe to the podcast at historyhit.com/artdetective. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. And I heartily recommend that all of you go out and buy Patrick's wonderful book, The Truth About Art. Your lives will be enriched as a result. Thanks all. Lots more exciting podcasts coming up. But for now, that was The Creation of Adam by Michelangelo. Thanks, Patrick.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.